Chapter 6. After we had been dating for 4 years, I married my late wife, Catherine Spath, in 1995. She had 2 young children at the time. In 2000, we had twins, Niccolo and Isabel, and in 2002, she gave birth to our daughter, Camilla. After being diagnosed in 2005 with stage 4 breast cancer, she died 4 years later in 2009 at the age of 47. She was extraordinary as a mother, wife, and friend. She was highly intelligent, beautiful, kind, patient, and one of the best people I will ever know. I loved her and always will. Her death is still incomprehensible to me, and her absence still unreal. Like me, Kate enjoyed good food, as was obvious on our first date in a little French restaurant in Manhattan called Tout Va Bien. It was opened in 1948, and I am happy to say it is still there. We both ordered their always delicious coq au vin, and I think Kate finished hers, half a baguette, and a couple glasses of wine before I'd even made a dent in my coq. When I first met her, she was a single mother running a daycare center out of her home to make ends meet. Yet no matter how tired she was after a grueling day, she cooked a well-balanced meal and had a proper sit-down dinner with her children every night. The meals were, for the most part, very simple and kid-friendly, but they were varied and nutritious, and subsequently both of her children became very good eaters. When I joined the family, Kate and I naturally started cooking together, and the number and types of dishes we prepared changed and grew. I introduced my family's recipes into our daily fare, and eventually, exactly like my wife Felicity, Kate usually ended up making them better than I did. Some of them much better. I remember one instance, not long before she was diagnosed, when Kate made my mother's recipe for lasagna bolognese, a dish that was every family member's favorite. Handmade plain and spinach pasta are layered into a baking pan with bolognese sauce, bechamella, and grated parmigiano. The result is an absurdly rich yet delicate dish that no one who eats it seems to be able to stop eating. Needless to say, it is very hard to get right. Pasta has to be the correct thickness, just thick enough to hold its shape and the sauce, but just thin enough to almost melt in your mouth after a single bite. The bolognese sauce cannot be too meaty, as this would make it too heavy, and it must also have the proper ratio of carrots, celery, onion, and tomato to give it the necessary sweetness. The bechamella cannot be either too runny or too claggy, as they say in Britain, and it must all be put together with great care so as not to damage the sheets of pasta. In short, if you have a lot of time and patience, you should try making it. If you don't, then really, just don't. You'll make yourself and everyone around you very unhappy. Kate had been experimenting with this dish for many years and succeeding brilliantly, but would always ask my mother for her opinion or for tips as to how she might improve upon it. My mother is very patient and encouraging when teaching people to cook, but because of her knowledge, experience, and prowess, she can be a bit intimidating. But Kate, as usual, was undaunted. Because of the time-consuming and labor-intensive process of the recipe, it was usually only served on special occasions. One day, just my parents, Kate, my stepdaughter Christine, the little kids, and I were celebrating something. What it might have been, I can't remember. But it was clearly significant enough for Kate to make this coveted culinary treat. As we all tucked in, it was immediately evident that she had outdone herself. While my dad and I were moaning with delight, I noticed my mother chewing slowly, her eyes fixed in a stare as though she were trying to make the flavors of what she had just put into her mouth permeate every last taste bud. A moment passed, and Kate looked at her and bravely asked, "What do you think, Joni?" My mother continued to chew silently with her eyes still focused on her plate. After a slight and not intense pause, she looked at Kate and said, "I have nothing left to teach you." And then she started to cry. Kate was beaming as she hugged my mother. The rest of us laughed. And then we devoured the lasagna. Eating with my in-laws, Kate's mother Dorothy and her second husband Brad, was a very different experience than what I have described when eating with my parents. Although I always enjoyed visiting them, they were not necessarily a couple who liked to cook. Like many people, they enjoyed food, but the process of preparing something beyond baked chicken or a steak or experimenting with new recipes was of no interest to them. Some people have a penchant for kitchen activities and others don't, but our visits were always enjoyable. Dorothy and Brad lived in a lovely home on the main coast, not far from Freeport, an old town now composed mostly of outlet stores such as L.L. Bean and Sebago. Most summers, Kate and I and my stepchildren, and then later our children, would drive the 5 hours north from Westchester for a visit. We would go out on their small boat to different islands, take hikes in the woods, or spend hours in the gargantuan L.L. Bean store in Freeport buying things we almost needed, like polar fleeces, thermoses, and carabiners. During our stays, inevitably, Kate and I would do the cooking because we knew what our kids would and wouldn't eat. Cooking made us happy, and being cooked for made my in-laws happy. But there was one meal that Brad made that neither Kate nor I would ever dare attempt. Brad had been born and bred in Maine and still spoke in the flat tones that maniacs are well known for. For those who have never visited, Maine is a beautifully rugged state with short summers and long, hard winters. Those born in Maine consider anyone not born in Maine an outsider, no matter how long that person may have lived there. They are, for the most part, a taciturn folk with a caustic, bone-dry sense of humor, an example of a Maine comic bon mot. Once, trying to make polite conversation at an uptight gathering at a small quote-unquote yacht club, I asked a member whether he had lived in Maine his whole life. His reply was a very deadpan, "Not yet." The conversation petered out pretty quickly after that. However, eating lobster plucked from Maine's ever-frigid coastal waters with friends and family is one tradition that seems to scrape the patrician barnacles off even the most stoic of the state's residents. The effort required by everyone at the table to break down and properly dissect a steamed lobster is an act that causes the participants to help one another complete the task. This act removes all barriers and can't help but spark conversation. I have eaten lobster in England, the Maldives, Ireland, and many other places, and yet my favorite is still a 1.5-pound lobster from Maine. I am not one who cares for his lobster grilled, thermidored, or Newburgh, however tasty they may be. I'm not saying I don't like lobster bisque and don't often crave a lobster roll on a lightly toasted buttered bun, but when it comes to fresh lobster, I think they are best gently boiled in salted water, and only butter, ideally clarified, is needed to enhance their flavor. This is how Brad cooked them every summer on the beach of a small island off the Maine coast. On the day of our arrival, Brad would look at the upcoming weather forecast and decide when might be best for our annual island lobster outing. After breakfast on the chosen day, we would fill coolers with beer, water, soda, hunks of cheese, and homemade smoked fish pate, stuff plastic bags with ears of corn and loaves of bread, gather the life jackets, and head down to the rocky shore that the house overlooked. In two old burlap sacks, Brad carried a battered and blackened aluminum pot, a small wire shelf from a defunct fridge, and a stash of firewood. We would all then climb into a little dinghy and row to the motorboat moored about 50 yards out. Settled into the boat, we'd head to a nearby marina, where there was a lobsterman Brad knew who sold the perfect-sized lobsters for a very fair price. Their quick, vicious claws rendered useless by taut rubber bands, the crustaceans were tossed into an empty cooler and whisked onto our boat. Making our way through the cold blue water toward a small island that had a less rocky beach than most of the other nearby islands, we would pass harems of seals swimming and sunning themselves on the jagged charcoal-colored rocks. The whole scene was a New England idyll, worthy of any Wyeth family member's bristles. We would moor the boat off the island, hop onto the dinghy, and rowed ashore. I make it all sound simple, but inevitably there was lots of swearing and cursing about mooring lines tied improperly, weight being distributed unevenly, how many trips it would take to get us all to shore, who would go first, and the designated rower's insufferable inability to row in a straight line. However, once we were on the island, tensions were eased by the sound of tabs being hastily pulled on cans of cold beer. Brad and the kids and I would gather stones and pile them in a circle that would contain the fire while Kate and her mom laid out the hors d'oeuvres. With the logs Brad had brought and some dried pine branches scavenged from the island, we lit a fire, balanced the old fridge grate on the stones above the flames, and waited for it to begin to burn evenly. After a few minutes, we filled the aluminum pot with seawater and placed it on the grate over the now roaring blaze. When the water came to a rolling boil, the lobsters were gently dropped in and covered with seaweed. The sweet corn, just shucked by the kids, was placed on top of the seaweed and then covered with more seaweed. Butter was melted in a little pot placed next to the fire while we ate cheese and crackers and waited impatiently for our main course. Pun intended and achieved. How Brad knew when the lobsters were ready is beyond me, because he never timed them. It seemed he just knew, and he was never wrong. The meat we pried from the shells was always cooked to perfection. We dipped it greedily into the melted butter and lathered cold butter on the hot corn, followed by a sprinkle of salt. Salt and butter. Butter and salt. Those two condiments elevated the flavors of an ancient plant and a prehistoric aquatic decapod to create a staggeringly delicious experience for us all. As I said, this was the only meal Brad ever cooked besides a burger or a steak on the barbecue, but we were all glad that he had directed his energies into perfecting it, because it was extraordinary. If and when fresh seaweed was at hand, Kate and I always cooked lobster using Brad's fail-safe method, and I pride myself on doing so successfully to this day. However, I'm still not even close to achieving Kate's repeated triumphs with lasagna alla bolognese, but I'm working on it. No doubt Felicity will do so before I've even left the gate.